Accession number 19658, Reel 1.
Doug Bushby, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Born in Marton, New Zealand. M-A-R-T-O-N.
Which island is that?
That's the North Island.
Which year were you born?
1931.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Marton?
Yes, I was educated in Palmerston North Boys High, which was 22 kilometres from Marton.
And how old were you when you left that school?
16.
So that must have been in 47.
That's correct.
Do you have any memories of the Second World War and its effects?
Yes, I was I lived out in the country, and everyone had to play a part. And even though I was only young, I became a air warden's runner, I think you'd call it.
Did you think the Japanese might attack New Zealand?
Very scared of the Japanese. There were talk of the submarines coming into our Wellington Harbour and Auckland and that. And being close to Australia was scary.
But no Japanese attack materialised?
No. They did bomb Darwin in Australia, which I think was the closest they ever got.
Did you follow the war at all closely?
Oh yes, we had blackouts and general air raid warnings, and only precautionary, you know, just for basic training and that if ever there was an attack. My father, being a farmer, he was given a wooden gun and became a home guardsman.
A wooden gun?
That's all a home guardsman had in New Zealand, was wooden rifles to train with.
So what happened? How did you come to be in the army yourself?
Well, after the war, they decided to have a conscription for compulsory military training. So out of the hat, they drew a birth date. You had to be 20 years of age, and then you were conscripted into the army through this ballot system. And I was July the 2nd, and my number 2 came out, so I had to do my compulsory military training. But I thought, well, why waste 12 weeks doing compulsory military training when I could volunteer and go to Korea? So needless to say, I enlisted to go to Korea. 98% of volunteers were, I should say, 98% of the troops that went to Korea were volunteers.
When was this, do you think, that you volunteered?
1952.
And what happened to you then?
Well, I did 6 weeks basic training, 6 weeks core training, and then we were flown over to Korea.
What was the basic training like?
It was pretty rough. As I say, they tried to make soldiers out of us within 12 weeks.
Where did you do it?
And initially, I did the core training in Wairu, which is a desert-lit area, much like Korea, covered in snow in the winter and barren and desolate in the summer.
Is that also in North Island?
Yes, that's in the middle of the North Island. It's on the desert road, that's why they built an army camp there. That's our main army camp in the North Island. And then my basic training, I went to Papakura.
Where's that?
Papakura, that's another army training centre in Auckland, which is the top of the North Island.
In what way was it rough, the training?
Well, they put us in tunnels and with blind entrances, and that you'd go in six at a time, and you'd throughout the period of training you'd find out where the tunnel openings were. Next day you'd go in again as confident as hell, just to find they blocked the entrances up and made another one. So it was all confusion, the whole training. And then in the latter part of it we had gas masks on, and then they put gas into them. That was a horrifying experience. And also we, to get used to the cold, they used to take us to a place called Tihoi, which is still not far from Wairu on the other side of the lake. And we had to have morning dips in this mountain streams and that. So we were pretty hardened for it. But I think in the 6 weeks we were doing the training, it certainly toughened us up. In the second part of the training, like, the transport people went down the South Island and were taught to drive and sort of do minor repairs to vehicles. And I was the signaller, so I sent up to Papakura to learn Morse. And I had to do 12 words a minute before I could go over to Korea. But I didn't tell them I could do 38 words a minute because I was a radio operator in the government. So I had a great 6 weeks just sitting doing nothing. And my instructor, he turned around and said, "Bushby, you're one bastard that won't pass." So when it came to my test, he gave me the 12 words a minute and I just leisurely sat down and wrote it. And then he said, "Right, now we'll get on the sending side." Well, I was about four times faster than him, and he just turned around and he was amazed. So I was a trained operator through the government.
Why did he want you not to pass?
Because I was lazy. I used to just sit back. I had a 6 weeks holiday. When we were doing the training, we had a signals van, and I was designated a driver, and my instructor was a bloke, Jack Brunton, and he used to get very upset that this driver and I kept going off the air all the time, and we were at a place called Kawakawa Bay, and other signal trucks were centred all around the Auckland area. So we used to go down and get mussels and cockles, as you call them, and then we'd say we'd have to go off the air, and then we'd go to the nearest village and buy a bottle of vinegar and have a sort of a little barbecue on the beach. And he accused us of being lazy and unthoughtful and everything, but as I said, I was fully trained operator, so we got away with murder.
Can you tell me more about the job you had with the government?
Yes, I was a radio operator, senior telegraphist. I stayed there even when I came back from Korea. They let me go to Korea with the understanding the government, anyone that went to Korea, they had to have their job back. That was a government understanding. As I say, we were all volunteers apart from one or two regulars went over, but 99% of the New Zealand members were all volunteers.
How did the people in charge of the basic training treat you?
Oh, they were very good because they knew they only had 6 weeks, and to get us ship shape, as I say, we went over there with just overall 12 weeks training, and it was a rush job. We were needed as, we went over as replacements to let, each term lasted approximately 21 months, and then they brought you home and sent another batch over as a replacement, or reinforcements, as they were sometimes called.
What happened to you next?
Well, we all went. The first lot of volunteers went on the SS Ormondy. They took all the guns and the jeeps and heavy machinery over on the Ormondy. And then there was another lot went over on the SS Wanganella. They called into Sydney, and then they called into Darwin to restock on the SS Wanganella. And then they headed off for Korea, and they hit a reef, I think it was called, just off the Marcel's Islands. And the boat sank with all our 25-pounders and everything on. So luckily there was a, I think it was an English shell tanker, picked our troops up. There was no panic. The ship stayed afloat for about 4 or 5 hours or longer. And then they were taken on board the tanker, and the others were transferred to a tug. And then next day, several New Zealand engineers went back on board the boat to disarm the 25-pounders to get the breaches out of the guns. But when they got there, all the rations and beer and everything had been pinched by the natives. But they rendered the 25-pounders and other weapons unserviceable, and then the ship sunk. They were then transported over, the replacements or reinforcements were then sent back to Darwin, and then I think they went over with one of the Australian battalions then, minus the guns, of course. So that was an eventful thing for them. But there was only 47 in our detachment, and we flew to Sydney by flying boat from Evans Bay and Wellington, and landed in Guam, and our New Zealand government was very generous. They gave us an American dollar each to spend in Guam, which lasted, I think you could buy a can of Coke for it. So in our lot of 47, we had some talented Maoris, and they got on stage and entertained all night. Needless to say, we ended up blind drunk by the end of the night through their singing and that, which was marvellous. And then from Guam, we went to Hiro in Japan, and we stayed a few days there.
Doing what?
Just changing uniform. We went out of our summer clothing into heavier and warmer uniforms, issued with boots, special boots and everything for walking in the snow. They had a sort of a sole that melted the snow as you walked, instead of, you know, clinging to your boots. We were very, very well equipped, but the earlier lot that went over, they were poorly dressed. They froze.
Can you tell me more about the equipment that you had?
Well, we had string vests, which sound nothing, but they were exceptionally warm. We had the string vests, which looked like a net, but they were very warm. And we had long johns with a flap on them, so if you wanted to go to the toilet, you just lifted the flap up, and that was the only thing that was exposed. The only drawback with them were you'd have these half 44-gallon drums you used as toilets, and you'd get some bright soldier who would turn around and light a newspaper and send it along these things, and all he could see was people jumping up left, right and centre. But they were an advantage because, I say, it was extremely cold in Korea and you were never without clothing.
Did you arrive in the winter?
I can't remember, to be quite honest, but we had winter clothing issued to us initially, and then when we arrived in Korea, we went to a place called FMA, which was Forward Maintenance Area, and that's where I was headquartered then. But we did have a sort of a mini Q store there. There was only, when I arrived, there was only 9 of us at FMA, consisting of 2 of us in Cypher, and the other 7 were Donar drivers. And they used to drive, say, from Seoul, where FMA was situated, to different areas like Tokchon and Incheon, to the detention centre, K-16, the airport, and deliver dispatches. And then they were picked up by other New Zealand Donar drivers that took them onwards up to the regiment and that. But to me, the Donars were essential, but each Donar driver had to have a shotgun. A shotgun as a person, as a escort. And he always carried a rifle, a .303 rifle, but we weren't allowed ammunition in them. So to me, it was just a have. But it looked impressive.
So you were based at the FMA?
I was based there for 11 months.
What were conditions like at FMA?
Well, we got away with murder. There was 320 or 390 Brits there who were very rigid in their dress and on parade tactics. And as I say, there was only 9 of us. And we, if they said, go on, come on, you've got to get on parade, we'd tell them to go and get stuffed. We wouldn't go. And we dressed sloppily. We used to grog on a lot. This is something I felt very sorry for the Brits, because when we drew pay, we got paid, the small contingent of us, we got paid virtually as much as the 300 POMs. And when they did get paid, if we got a free bottle of beer or something like that from the government, they used to try and sell it to us just to get a few bob.
Did they succeed?
Well, we hated their guts over there because, you know, they were, to us, they were toffee-nosed, and we were as rough as guts. And even lights out, we'd always carry a crate of grog up to the room, and we'd, even the English officers used to come round, like checking up to see all lights were out, they'd always end up in our dorm. But it wasn't all party, don't think for a minute, but weekends we always played up.
So what does grog on mean? What does the phrase grog on mean?
Well, grog on, or get on the terps. In other words, we got on the piss.
You started to drink the beer?
Yeah.
So you hated the, you said you hated the toffee-nosed way they went on. Was that the officers, or did that include all of them?
That, mainly the officers, because we had no respect for them. They couldn't charge us. If we did anything wrong, we had to be charged by a New Zealand ranking officer. We did have a lieutenant in charge of us, and but any serious crime, we had to go up to the regiment and be charged up there, which became a fallacy. No one had the time to send us up there, but the poor Brit, if he didn't have his hat on straight, he was doing the marched in, and they were so rigid with him, and they were only kids, they were only 18-year-olds, whereas we had to be 20 to volunteer, And we weren't allowed in a war zone until we were 21. So there was a difference of at least 3 to 4 years on the Brits. So they were just still kids. But getting away from Korea, when I went to a reunion in Washington or the unveiling of a war memorial there, we all stayed at the Radisson Hotel, and I went down to the bar and it was full of Brits. And I said, it's taken me 40 years to like you bastards. And we have been great friends ever since.
How did you get on with this lieutenant that was in charge of you?
Oh, he was an odd bod, but we just all did our jobs and that was it. He had no complaints. I remember one instance when he left and another lieutenant took over, Lieutenant McLaughlin. He got a brand new Jeep and he said to my friend Bernie Finn, he says, I want you and Finn to take the Jeep up to the regiment for a run. So off we go, and we excuse me, we had an accident and I ended up in a paddy field plus the Jeep and Bernie, and we ended up in a Canadian hospital. So they rang the lieutenant and said, oh, I've got two of your boys in the hospital here. And he said, oh, your Jeep's a write-off. He said, to hell with the Jeep. He said, how are my boys? I thought that was a wonderful gesture. We only were there to get stitched up and that. So he sent another Jeep up to bring us home, and he was a wonderful person. That was Lieutenant McLaughlin. But the only thing about being at FMA was the English food. It was foul. And we were able to buy bottles of whiskey or bourbon, and we used to trade it to the Americans because they, funny enough, they used to love bourbon and whiskey, but they couldn't buy it as readily as we could. And we used to end up with turkeys. Well, they said they were turkeys, but they were that big they looked like ostriches. So we used to feed them into the cookhouse and they used to cook them up. And so we lived fairly highly, and it wasn't only food we got. We had these Jeeps, and as I say, in the winter it was terribly cold. So we used to trade more bourbon and more whiskey, and we ended up with heaters in our Jeeps. Now, we had no engineers or mechanics to fit them, but luckily they had some young Brits down just below the base camp, and they used to fit the heaters for us and say how lucky we were. And I might add, one of the people that was very close to us in repairing and doing the general maintenance on the Jeeps got in touch with me just a week ago. I've never seen or heard from him for 50 years. Everything was a coincidence. So I've been to stay with him in Scunthorpe.
What was the problem with this English food?
Well, it was all plastic potato and corned beef, you know, stuff we weren't used to. We used to lots of vegetables, but everything was beans or spam, plastic potato, and it was just horrible.
How do you mean plastic potato?
Well, plastic potato, it was just a powder mixed with milk or water or something like that, and, you know, food we were never used to. So we used to rely heavily on our compact rations, which we used to get every month. They had, you know, sort of biscuits and cakes and that in them.
Was that New Zealand or America?
Yeah, New Zealand.
What would a New Zealand soldier get for food then?
Up at the regiment?
Yes.
Well, they were better fed. It was They still had a lot of powdered stuff, but the meals were better. We used to get more stews than that.
What were your living conditions like? What was your accommodation like at FMA?
At FMA, the Brits had commandeered the school, and most of our volunteers lived in a dormitory, but I used to share a tent. See, in Cypher, I was given two stripes, which was an automatic thing when you were in decoding. So I virtually, according to the English law, I wasn't allowed to mix with the ORs. So I had to share a tent, which was actually a sort of a mini Q store, with a sergeant. And we had our own little heater in it and that, petrol driven.
And were there any fights between the Kiwis and the English?
Oh, there were one or two, but we used to have two Scotch cooks. I think they'd spent most of their life in jail, and they were as tough as hell. And if anyone tried to get into a scrap with us, they used to always come to our aid. They were marvellous. That's why we used to get the turkeys, and they used to cook them up, not only for us, but for other Brits as well.
Were you happy at this FMA place then?
Yes, everyone was quite happy. As I say, we got away with murder. We didn't go on parade, but we did our jobs, and that was what we were there for.
Can you tell me more about the job that you were doing there, please, and the equipment that you had?
Well, we worked closely with the Americans in the cipher and decoding and that. But to get into cipher, you had to sign a form, a code of silence. So basically, we were just in cipher and sending and transmitting messages by Morse code.
What were the main problems of doing that job?
There were no problems.
Was reception all right in Korea?
Oh, reception was good, yeah. Oh, the Americans were well up on the, you know, basic transmitting things. After I'd been to FMA, when they closed the New Zealanders down from FMA, I went up to the regiment. I was attached to regimental headquarters attached to 163 battery, and we didn't do any signalling at all up there, apart from further up. It was DivSigs that did all the transmitting of messages, but it was mainly voice frequency and not Morse.
Did you prefer that?
I didn't have to do it. I luckily got a job in the Q store, so I was very fortunate.
What did that job involve?
Distributing of clothing on request and issuing of rum when it got below zero. And or I had to calculate the food for each regiment on a slide.